Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, June 7th, 2019 program, Knowledge Production at the University of Oregon. What have those students been up to? Or rephrased, student research in 2019. This is the 35th program for our 2018-2019 programming year. And my name is Eric Richardson. I'm the president of City Club. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, and you can become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors from our community, and our diamond sponsors are follow. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support also comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, the University of Oregon has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. At Peace Health, their mission is a shared purpose. Since they were founded 125 years ago, they were founded to promote personal community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, and to treat each person in a loving and caring way. For more information, visit Peace Health at peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor today is Palo Alto Software. For more than 20 years, Palo Alto Software has had a commitment to educating and empowering entrepreneurs and small businesses. With their headquarters in Eugene, they're best known for LivePlan, a lean planning software tool. More information at paloalto.com. Now I'd like to bring to the microphone Mary Layton, who is today's program coordinator.
Thanks, Eric. In the Eugene-Springfield metro area, the total population is 250,000. About 25%, 64,000, are students. And a bit more than half of these students are enrolled in local post-secondary institutions. Thanks to regular reminders from City Club member John Brown, we hold space for these young neighbors in our understanding of the concept of community. We keep in mind that building community vision must include the students whose skills, perceptions, and thoughtful priorities can inform our thinking and inspire action, even though many are still too young to vote. Students eat lunch at City Club as John's guests. Whenever I see one of those Evans Elder Brown and Subert signs, my gratitude is renewed, so hats off to you, John. This program celebrates how great universities enrich us all. We're used to hearing about the world-changing work of the professors. Across ages, university faculties have generated knowledge that transforms our lives. But today, we hear from their protégés, who are already making big contributions. Two of the presenters are just finishing their sophomore years. Two will graduate in June, this month, a couple of weeks. But all four have used well the opportunities we provided, at least in small part, for them to learn amazing things. The return on this public investment is significant, as you will soon hear. In May, the University of Oregon hosted its 9th annual undergraduate research symposium. I mean, think about that. When you were a kid, did you think about undergraduate research symposium as a thing? More than 500 undergraduates presented their original research, creative work, and community-based projects. Today, we will hear from a small cross-section of these students. Our first speaker is Calvin Penkakis. Cal was born and raised in Bakersfield, California. He calls himself a non-traditional student and has a double major in biology and environmental science. He's finishing his sophomore year at UO. Cal is in the middle of a research project on my brother's farm in Cresswell. This 320-acre organic farm produces filberts and pork, among other things. Its owners are actively exploring methods that increase biodiversity and food production as the farm transitions from grass seed production. Cal is studying how to resolve the conflict between oak conservation and organic hazelnut production. This seems to involve turning acorns into bacon. Cal?
Thank you, Mary. And thank you, City Club Eugene, for inviting us here today. It is a privilege of mine to live and to study in such an amazing city, such as Eugene, let alone one with a large, active, and supportive community of people. It's an honor to have the opportunity to conduct research in a beautiful state such as Oregon. Oregon grows almost all of the hazelnuts, or filberts, within the United States and about 5% worldwide. The main cost associated with growing hazelnuts is pest load reduction. So filbert worm is the key pest for hazelnuts in the Pacific Northwest, and the one that creates the most economic impact, single-handedly reducing crop yields to up to 40%. The filbert worm moth lays its eggs on several species of nut-producing plants. Apart from hazelnuts, they particularly like Oregon white oak acorns. Oregon white oak is a keystone species and one of conservation in the Willamette Valley, with it persisting in less than 5% of its historical range. Most of what remains is on private agricultural land. These oak woodlands maintain source populations of filbert worm and are a potential liability to hazelnut growers. After the filbert worm emerges from its egg, it burrows into the nut and starts to consume the inside, making the nut unusable. If the conditions are just right, and when the filbert worm is developmentally ready, it exits the nut and pupates into a moth. It otherwise overwinters in the leaf litter and pupates the following spring. Because of this, there's a partial second generation during the long summer flight season. This results in compounding pest loads in hazelnut orchards and higher infestation rates in the fall. Infested nuts are known to fall early in the season, and the filbert worms are vulnerable while the exposed nuts are on the ground. It's during this time in the fall that we hope to target and disrupt the filbert worm's life cycle. I'm investigating whether controlled grazing by pigs or hogs can disrupt the life cycle of filbert worm and reduce its pest load in an organic hazelnut orchard by reducing its abundance in a nearby woodland. If successful, this woodland pasture technique could potentially create a win-win scenario for both Oregon white oak conservation and organic hazelnut production. Over a year ago, I started this project alongside Alejandra Bambila from the Hallett Lab at the University of Oregon. We get all the technical glitches out of the way right now. So we partner with Taylor Larson from My Brother's Farm, an organic farm outside of Creswell, Oregon. Along with his two brothers, Austin and Ben, the family seeks to foster stewardship of the land and develop more sustainable farming practices. My Brother's Farm is transitioning from annual grass seed production to a more diversified crops, including bison, hops, apples, and of course, hogs and hazelnuts, to say the least. Situated near the Coast Fork Willamette River, the farm has helped with riparian restoration and is involved in multiple research projects, including this one. Overall, the farm's mindful focus on biodiversity, water quality, and strengthening the community has led to many partnerships over the years. Last summer, we sampled filbert worm from an oak woodland and hazelnut orchard at My Brother's Farm. To catch the filbert worm moth as it's emerging from the leaf litter, we built over 40 ground traps. To sample filbert worm abundance in the canopy, we used up to 16 sticky traps, all of which had pheromone lures and were replaced up to 5 times during the long summer flight season. In the fall of last year, we established control and grazing plots or pastures in the oak woodland and hazelnut orchard. I sampled acorns before and after the hogs went through the woodland, and sure enough, we found that they significantly reduced the number of acorns on the woodland floor. Because we targeted the nuts that fell early in the season, most of what was consumed were infested. The opposite happened in the control pasture, in which the wildlife preferred to graze on healthy acorns instead. This is exciting because it demonstrates that hogs pasturing in the woodland do in fact glean infested nuts. Hopefully this translates into lower filbert worm abundance this year with major cost avoidance for hazelnut growers in the future. Because we divided the woodland pasture into smaller segments and limited the time in each one, the disturbance by the hogs on the vegetation was minimized while ensuring even grazing among the pasture. Second year filbert worm sampling is currently underway at my brother's farm, with the traps being set up just this last weekend. Additionally, second year grazing and acorn sampling is scheduled for this fall, with a third year of filbert worm sampling next spring. I will be presenting my preliminary results at the North American Agroforestry Conference in Corvallis at the end of this month. There, I hope to connect with industry leaders and other organic hazelnut growers in order to gain feedback and potentially scale the project into other organic farms in the Willamette Valley. I would like to give a special thanks to everyone in the Hallett Lab for their guidance and to Taylor Larson for all of his invaluable insight and help implementing the pastures and wrangling the hogs. Also, it was a thing. Also, I would like to thank the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program and the Center of Undergraduate Research and Engagement for helping me expand this project this year with additional filbert worm sampling and supplementary acorn sampling methods. Finally, I would like to express my gratitude to all of you who have come to listen to us today. So thank you for your time.
So that's what those kids have been up to. Karishma Shah is from Portland. She graduates from the University of Oregon next week with a double major, one in operations and business analytics, and the other in Spanish. She can also get by in Gujarati and Italian. Karishma's research is about healthy food, just like Cal's, but she has taken a different angle. She studied the economic impacts of food gentrification. Think about food gentrification, big thing in my life, on communities of color in Portland. She will describe the quantitative impacts of gentrification in the food industry and how it contributes to the displacement of Portland's communities of color. Karishma?
Thank you all for being here today. I'm presenting my honors thesis on calculating the economic impacts of food gentrification on communities of color in Portland, Oregon. So to start, what is food gentrification? Food gentrification can be one of two things. It can either be the gentrification of ingredients themselves, such as oxtail, collards, or kale. In these situations, these ingredients become trendy, and as a result, they become more expensive. The communities that originally used these ingredients in their cuisine can no longer afford to purchase them. The second kind of food gentrification is the type that this thesis focuses on: food gentrification as it pertains to restaurants. And these situations occur when a person opens a restaurant that serves a cuisine that is ethnically different from their own culture. So this thesis argues that food gentrification is a combination of two things. First, that it is a form of cultural appropriation. And second, that food gentrification can either trigger or accelerate gentrification in neighborhoods. So what does food gentrification as a form of cultural appropriation even look like? I have an example of a food cart in Portland that was opened by two white women, Willis and Connolly. It was called Cook's Burritos. The two women traveled to Puerto Nuevo, Mexico about a year prior to opening their restaurant. While there, they were trying to study how to make a tortilla. They asked local women for their recipes, and after these women were unwilling to share, Willis and Connolly took it upon themselves to sneak behind the back of kitchens and restaurants to look inside windows and study how the women were making tortillas. After they returned to Portland, they opened their food truck after spending a significant amount of time developing their tortilla recipe, and then they gave an interview to Willamette Weekly about their research methods. And about a week after this interview was published, Cook's Burritos shut down. During this week, there was a lot of important conversation and talk in the restaurant industry about what cultural appropriation is as it pertains to food and how we can engage in it appropriately. As it turns out, food gentrification and cultural appropriation are really hard to define because there are no copyright or legal protections for recipes or for food. So why do we care? Why does food gentrification matter? This quote by Matt Hearn pertains to Portland specifically and defines the problem. There's no longer a single minority-majority neighborhood left in Portland, quite possibly the only major city in North America that can claim that, and it is certainly the whitest city in the country. A minority-majority neighborhood is simply one where there are more people of color than there are white people. It's important that we understand how and why this happened so that we can fully understand the problem of gentrification. In recent years, people of color have been forced to move out of their homes in Portland that they have lived in for generations. The role that restaurants and grocery stores play in this can help us further understand the problem of gentrification. The aim of my research was to create a comprehensive definition of food gentrification in relation to Portland's rapidly changing neighborhoods. In order to achieve this, I split my thesis into two parts. First was a literature review, and the second part was a data analysis composed of a qualitative analysis and a quantitative analysis. For the literature review, I studied one study that was put together by a committee in Portland that's headed by the mayor of Portland. They found that in 2018, almost 34,000 Portland households were at risk of displacement, 14,000 of which were in East Portland. They also found that in East Portland, people of color, which they considered to be vulnerable populations, were already being displaced. The second thing that we see in Portland is the Whole Foods effect. This occurs when any health food grocery store, not just Whole Foods, moves into a lower income neighborhood. Ultimately, rent prices increase because it signals to local businesses, to smaller businesses, that this is a potential growth area. As a result, smaller businesses such as bars, restaurants, and gyms open in these neighborhoods, and higher income residents want to move in. Lower income residents are priced out, or they may feel unwelcome in these neighborhoods. Throughout all of my research on food deserts, food mirages, movement activism, and a number of other things, I found that restaurants, grocery stores, and other food establishments can, in fact, trigger or accelerate gentrification in these neighborhoods. So, are there solutions? In short, yes. I realize that it's unrealistic to ask that people only open restaurants for the ethnicity in which they are from, and frankly, it's unsustainable. But there are ways that we can engage in this appropriation ethically. For starters, we can hire people from different races, different cultural backgrounds, and different nationalities. Many people with the Cook's Burritos food cart asked, would it not be cheaper, more convenient, and more sustainable to just hire a Mexican chef? The other things that we can do is to research the context of recipes we are using, the ingredients. We can do our research. We can ask people from those cultures to taste our food, and then we can give credit where credit is due. So for the second part of my thesis, I did a data analysis. As I mentioned before, this was composed of the quantitative and the qualitative analyses. For the quantitative analysis, I built a database using Yelp data. I chose to use Yelp data because in my research I found that if a restaurant has a higher number of stars on Yelp, they do see an increase in profits. Because this was the thing that I was most interested in studying, profits, I decided to use Yelp data. I studied a number of different variables, such as number of reviews, number of photos, whether or not the Yelp page was claimed, the type of food, the type of ambiance, and many different things. However, throughout my research, I found that the only variable that could predict a restaurant's rating, the restaurant's number of stars, with any statistical significance was whether or not it was located in a gentrified neighborhood. Consequently, the only thing that could predict a restaurant's profits in Portland was where it was located. For the qualitative analysis, I sent a survey to every accessible restaurant in my database. So there were 100 restaurants in my database across four Portland neighborhoods, two of which were gentrified, and two were landing zones. Landing zones are where people move once they are displaced due to gentrification. I asked a number of different questions about the number of employees the restaurant has, the average amount a restaurant spends or a customer spend, the size of the restaurant, and about cultural training that the restaurant provides. My most important finding was that about the cultural training, only one restaurant that responded to my survey mentioned that they provided any cultural training at all, and they described it as providing in-depth training on the history of the cuisine, each dish, and the spirits that originate in that country. They also have guest chefs who train their staff as well. This is in line with some of the solutions that I found from my earlier literature review. This thesis allowed me to ask a lot of important questions about cultural appropriation, if a group of people can even own a cuisine, if there are ways to engage in cultural appropriation ethically, but it is only the start of a much important, much larger conversation that needs to be taking place amongst the restaurant industry, but also amongst us as consumers. Thank you.
I was thinking about a family that Marty brought over from Kabul. The wife, who'd never had a job in Kabul, being a traditional Muslim woman, was hired very soon after arrival in Beaverton by a restaurant that cooked Afghan food. It was something she did extremely well, we were all in a position to say. So think about that as a way not to appropriate, but to engage the resources that people land with. Awesome research. Well, we'll talk about that. okay. Next, we have Nisha Sridhar. Nisha is a stamp scholar from Corvallis. That means she was one of the top 10 of about 2,000 in-state students in her class. She is also a Wayne Moore Scholar and a University Innovation Fellow. But wait, there's more. She's passionate about advocacy and is working with her state representative, Dan Rayfield, and perhaps yours too, Marty Wilde, soon, to craft a bill making education on organ donation mandatory in Oregon. In the project she will describe, conducted with Camille Sullivan, Nisha looked at the mechanisms by which stress affects parents' responsiveness to their children. Their goal is to identify the neurobiological indicators of caregiver reward that can provide insight on how stress impacts responsive caregiving. That would provide a quantitative way to measure the effectiveness of parenting interventions. Nisha is finishing her second year at the University of Oregon and hopes for a career in pediatric neurology. Nisha?
Thank you, Mary, and thank you guys for having me here today. This is really an exciting opportunity for me. So I'm working at the Stress Neurobiology Prevention Lab, which is led by Dr. Phil Fisher. And within this lab, there's a project known as the ORCA study. And actually, two of my mentors are here today, Anna Wright and Leticia Hayes. So thank you guys for being here. And so the project is led by Dr. Tyson Barker, and we're working with a bunch of other undergraduate research assistants. To start off, I want to emphasize the importance of early experiences on the brain development of a child. So a child's early environment shapes the way that their brain is wired. Children are constantly interacting with the world around them, experimenting and learning, and this shapes the way that their brain is developed. Neural circuits that are used frequently are strengthened, and those that are not get weakened. So this emphasizes how important that the relationships and the experiences we provide children early on in life affects their development and affects them long term as well, into adulthood as well. So first off, I'm going to define the term responsive caregiving. So what is responsive caregiving? Responsive caregiving refers to the ability of a parent to be sensitive to their child's needs and respond appropriately. So many studies have found that positive caregiving behaviors, such as responsive caregiving and providing emotional support, as two examples, can improve child's social emotional outcomes. So parents play a central role in a child's early experience. A strong, nurturing parent can help buffer early adversity, such as severe poverty and neglect, and support the development of a healthy child. When we think about child health, we mainly think about providing pediatrics, and we think about it through a healthcare services lens, but a supportive or responsive caregiver is just as important, if not more. So caregiving is actually a naturally rewarding behavior that's been conserved evolutionarily. There are areas of the brain that are specifically associated with parenting. We can call it a parenting brain. In fact, the same areas of the brain that are associated with reward processing are thought to be associated with responsive caregiving. So the area of the brain known as the anterior cingulate cortex, which is responsible for processing reward, is also responsible for responsive caregiving. So this presents us an opportunity to study responsive caregiving by measuring the electrical activity in the anterior cingulate cortex. So one way we can measure the parenting brain is using something known as an EEG. So you guys might have seen this in movies or something, and it looks kind of scary, but it really isn't. So an EEG is just a cap with electrodes, and it just measures the electrical activity of your brain. So when an individual experiences a reward, and this is processed in the brain, there's an electrical signal, and we can record and measure the signal using an EEG. So this presents us with an opportunity to measure reward. So in our lab, we study rewards using a task known as the Doors Game. So when a parent and a child come into our lab and we administer this game, and so essentially what happens is the parent plays this game on their own wearing an EEG cap on, and the EEG is recording their brain activity as they receive a reward, which is money, so they receive 10 cents. And then the parent observes their child play the same game, but this time their child is receiving goldfish, so some sort of treat. And so they're observing their child while wearing the EEG net. And so from this, we can see how rewarding a child's behavior is to the caregiver. So the response of a participant during the game to reward is measurable using an EEG and is referred to as reward positivity. From previous studies, interestingly, we see that individuals who see their social partners receive a reward experience the same sort of electrical activity in their brain, even though they themselves are not the ones receiving the reward. So in our study, we want to see if caregivers have experienced reward positivity when observing their child receive a reward. Essentially, this means that we're looking at how the parent brain, reward brain, is activated when they observe their child being rewarded. So why is this important? Understanding responsive caregiving can help us develop parenting interventions targeted towards families facing adversity. Good nutrition, education, and healthcare are very important for child development, but responsive caregiving is the glue that brings these things all together, and they can help facilitate the development of a child into becoming a happy and healthy adult. Yeah.
Finally, we're going to hear from Alexandra Waldron. Allie's from Medford. She's worked with communities all over the world. I asked her how that happened, and she said she went on a mission trip and discovered she really loved travel, so then she went on other trips that weren't mission trips. She's also worked in the relief nursery in Eugene. She graduates next week with a major in human physiology and minors in chemistry and global health. For her honors college thesis, Allie studied maternal and child health technologies at a teaching hospital in Cape Coast, Ghana. We often assume that the advantages of technologies, of the medical technologies, are self-evident and universal, and therefore using them in any setting is unproblematic. Allie wondered if this was true. So she shadowed clinicians in Oregon and Ghana to explain how, when exported to the Ghanaian context, certain technologies affected healthcare and relationships among all concerned. Allie?
I spent the summer of 2017 in Cape Coast, Ghana, shadowing doctors, medical students, and nurses at Cape Coast Teaching Hospital. I had the privilege to learn about what it means to care for patients and their families in the face of scarce resources and understaffing. But I also had the opportunity to see medicine operate in a context strikingly different from that which I was familiar. Shadowing in Oregon, I was used to seeing medical technology functioning flawlessly as expected pieces of the clinical landscape. I was always fascinated by these innovative medical devices, only really seeing their ability to improve the productivity and availability of healthcare. But my experience in Ghana made me consider how these medical devices function within the global health framework. My research is based on ethnographic field notes recorded while shadowing here at Cape Coast Teaching Hospital, which I'll refer to as CCTH. Exporting foreign medical technologies into the clinical spaces of the Global South is often expected to lead directly to health equity. The export of medical technologies from the Global North to the Global South is often based on this simplistic assumption that the advantages of foreign technology are self-evident and universal. Medical technology granted this power is presumed to be fit for all, a neutral, universal lifesaver with the power to transcend culture to improve health around the world. This comes with the idea that medical technology remains static as it transverses borders, that it retains its original purpose and meaning as it travels. However, my thesis interrogates this idea of the global movement of technology as an unalloyed good. I challenge the concept of neutral, fit-for-all technology by exploring medical technology in context at Cape Coast Teaching Hospital. In my research, I ask, what happens when medical technology designed and first used in the Global North is transferred internationally to a different healthcare system? How does medical technology affect existing healthcare arrangements and relationships, and in turn, how is it affected by them? And what does this process say about global health aid and the relationships between the Global North and South? To explore these questions, I performed a content analysis on my field notes to investigate three technologies involved in maternal and newborn health: the fetal ultrasound, the pulse oximeter, and the neonatal incubator. In my research, I first outlined how these technologies function in the Global North using my shadowing experience in Oregon. Then I explore how they become both changeable objects and objects for change at CCTH. I found that these technologies change to fit the needs of the doctors and patients, while also working to change the way people relate to each other and their illnesses in four major ways. First, each technology mediated clinical interactions between doctors, nurses, patients, and their caregivers. Second, the technologies affected perceptions of illness and treatment. Third, all the technologies gained and lost meaning and purpose. And lastly, each technology functioned in the clinical space as a broken or limited piece of equipment. Due to my limited time, I'll just briefly touch on one example for each technology. My first example is the ultrasound as it mediated clinical interactions. When women became patients for ultrasound at CCTH, it highlighted the power and authority disparity between doctor and patient. The doctors rarely explained the ultrasound image to their patients as they did the exam. And often the monitor was angled so the patient couldn't even see the image on the screen. The ultrasound machine donated to the hospital didn't even have a screen capable of rotating. It was fixed in place. In this way, the presence of the machine became a barrier that further elevated the gap between unknowing patient and skilled doctor that ran throughout the hospital. My second example is the pulse oximeter as it gained new meaning and purpose at CCTH. The pulse oximeter measures the amount of oxygen in your blood when it's clipped onto your finger. Instead of being used as a continual monitor like it was in Oregon, the device was used as a spot check device at CCTH. Since there was only one functioning pulse oximeter on the whole pediatrics floor, it moved around the ward, spending only a few minutes on each patient before moving to the next. The pulse oximeter also gained new meaning as a way to ration the limited supply of supplemental oxygen on the ward floor, because clinicians could better determine which patients were in the most critical need. My last example is how the neonatal incubator functioned as a broken and limited technology. Incubators were a valued resource at CCTH, so a broken machine was never immediately removed from the clinical space. Instead, they were repurposed. One was used for linen storage, while its plastic canopy was removed and fitted to a different incubator. Broken incubators were also kept on the ward floor as a source of technological pride. Even though the incubator was broken, it was still a monument showcasing the hospital's ability to integrate advanced technology into newborn care. Hospital staff also put together a makeshift warmer to maintain newborn baby's body temperature when the available incubators were full. As seen in this picture, a bank of lights was leaned up against the wall next to a mattress to provide warmth. The limited availability of incubators also meant that two or three babies were placed in each functioning device. The first point of discussion my results leads to is the idea that context matters for the way medical technology is experienced and affects the healthcare system. Expected goals of medical technology include giving health staff increased accuracy and efficiency in diagnosing and treating their patients. However, my results show that inserting medical technology into a locality different from the one it was designed for also leads to unintended consequences on the clinical environment, people, and technology itself. My research also brings up this idea of exporting quote-unquote appropriate technology for developing countries. With this phrase comes the assumption that Ghana is impoverished, uneducated, and in desperate need of outside expertise, and that our technology will statically transfer to this new context to carry out the same purpose it does here. However, my results reveal that talking about quote-unquote appropriate technology for developing countries in this way is policy talk, not an observed reality. It's important to point out that this appropriate technology we choose to donate or export is portable, cheap, less complex, and often outdated. Another topic my results bring up is the idea of brokenness and ingenuity within the clinical space. In Oregon, malfunctioning or inaccurate technology was quickly removed from the clinical space. But in Cape Coast, the distinction between a working technology and the useless machine was less clear. The many broken, faulty, and in some cases unusable pieces of donated equipment call for the reevaluation of medical technology donation. What is donated and how it is donated speaks volumes about the dynamics between sending and receiving institutions. Additionally, malfunctioning technology elicited improvisation and ingenuity from the local healthcare staff, who took it upon themselves to tinker with the equipment in attempts to repair it or grant it a new purpose. Thinking about Ghanaian healthcare staff as innovators and fixers allows for the reconsideration of the depiction of African healthcare as in desperate need of outside assistance. Comparison across the three medical devices also reveals the power of medical technology to either generate or diminish distance between patient and other health professional. The ultrasound and incubator created further distance between people by acting as communication barriers, reducing the need for physical patient contact, and increasing reliance on medical machine over trained person. In contrast, the pulse oximeter worked to pull doctor and patient together by mediating open communication, requiring constant physical contact, and calling for human interpretation. In conclusion, by exploring how the ultrasound, the pulse oximeter, and the incubator are changed and change in this context, I presented evidence against the idea that medical technology can be transferred globally and remain a static element of health. Medicine is not a neutral institution, and the way it is exported can speak to the way we characterize people from other parts of the world. I hope that by exploring the way medicine travels, this thesis not only pushes for a deeper understanding of Ghana and its people, but a truer understanding of what biomedicine is and can become in the hands of all the world's people. Thank you.
Okay, well now, thank you all for those very enlightening research projects. We're very fortunate to have you in our community. Right now, we're going to take a small break so we can formulate our questions at the table, and then we'll be back in about 5 minutes to go ahead and start our answering question session. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
So welcome back to the June 7th, 2019 program, Knowledge Production at the University of Oregon. What have those students been up to? Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our sponsors. First, our gold sponsors, Arriving by Bike, Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union, Emergency Veterinarian Hospital, Sacred Earth Botanicals. And a special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Dot Dotson's Photography, and Pack Info and Simplified Computing LLC. Now with our questioning sessions, please come to the mic. We've got Paul Thompson, first questioner.
Yeah, this is Paul Thompson. I've been a City Club member for off and on for a decade or so. Thank you so much for coming. They were four blockbuster presentations, and they showed a lot of work in distilling out the essence of what you did, and I appreciate you being able to do that in a constrained amount of time. I wondered if one or more of you could speak to the mechanics of putting together the research that you did. For instance, is it an elective or a mandatory part of your education? How are the topics approved? What kind of mentorship do you have during the time? Do you get a grade on it? Are they archived? Those kinds of things. So whoever would like to speak to that.
Different for everybody, but for me personally, and I know for Allie as well, we're in the Honors College, so it is a necessary part of our graduation requirements, so we have to produce an honors thesis and defend it. We have three members of our thesis committee, so we have an honors professor, and then we have one person in our department who's our primary advisor, and we have a secondary advisor. We don't get credit for it unless we want to, and we aren't graded on it, but we can pass with honors or pass with distinction. Oh, and it is archived online unless we are choosing to produce it. Oh, my name is Karishma.
Hello, my name is Cal Pankaskis, and so I'm a non-traditional student. I am not part of the Honors College, but as an elective of sorts, I am able to take research credit, and that goes towards my degree. And because I'm be producing a thesis at the end of it, I will be graduating with honors, but not from the Honors College. So there's different roads to get into undergraduate research. One is Honors College, which is focused on producing research, and the other is undergraduates just have the volition to step up and look for a lab that's recruiting, and to find a project, either an original question that they have, or be part of a research project already in bloom.
My name is Nisha, and just to kind of go off of what everybody else has been saying, the University of Oregon has many different labs, and they all have led by professors, and undergraduates are a really important part of all of these labs, so they're constantly recruiting students to be part of their labs. So actually, through one of the recruitment processes, I was able to join the Stress Neurobiology and Prevention Lab, and there's many other undergraduate research assistants working there. So just to reiterate, like undergraduates are a huge part of research at the University of Oregon. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm Jack Tresser. I have a question directed to Nisha. I'm a retired psychologist. So I was very interested in this method of operationalizing empathy. And this relationship between the infant and the caretaker. In psychoanalytic theory, this is absolutely crucial. This is what basically shapes our attitudes of optimism or pessimism about other human beings for the rest of our lives. And there's a fascinating study done years ago by a neuropsychologist named James Prescott, where he found that touching during infancy was the number one, it was one of only two, and it was the most powerful predictor that differentiated violent and nonviolent cultures. And so I'm wondering if this operational method has been applied to other relationship models, you know, husband, wife, et cetera.
I was wondering, my name is Nisha, I was wondering if you could clarify your question. What do you mean by operationalizing?
In psychological research, we have these variables. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's empathy. Well, how do you actually measure empathy?
Oh, okay.
You see?
So we have my name is Nisha again. So we do different surveys, and we also have an interaction challenge where we observe a parent and child interacting together, and we video record it. And then afterwards, a team codes it. So essentially, they're looking for different things like markers of empathy and social effects. So when they go in afterwards, they're able to measure empathy and through the surveys as well. So that's how they're able to look into those things.
Randy Prince, a City Club member. I have a question about the food gentrification topic. I can certainly see the point here about how an increasing number of sit-down restaurants in a neighborhood is evidence and a harbinger of gentrification on its way. I was wondering about food carts, street vendors, different economic profile. Portland has lots of vendors, many of whom will be displaced soon in the downtown core, but it also and Portland is where you studied this issue, residential neighborhoods that have seen this gentrification, but street vendors are often very authentic, and the countries in the developing world where many of the people come from, it's a very important thing. Do you see that as having a different logic to it, the presence of street vendors, not necessarily, or further evidence of gentrification, and do you think any policies might be adopted to favor or discourage these ethnically inclined restaurants?
All right, this is Karishma. That's a very good question. I wasn't able to get into it in my presentation, but my thesis, I did find that the food cart blocks in Portland align very closely with the most gentrified tracts of Portland, which I don't think is very surprising at all. But I did think that it was interesting because, as you mentioned, people that frequent food carts might be demographically different from people that frequent trendy, hip restaurants. But I do think that because of the size of Portland and because of the urban growth boundary and because of how quickly Portland is growing as far as people moving in but not expanding at all, I don't think that we will see an increase in the number of food cart blocks in Portland in the near future as they are shutting down for development. Portland was planned around these blocks, and I don't see the city of Portland adding any new ones in the near future, but I don't know if there are any city recommendations.
How about out in the neighborhoods, like I think it's like Alberta area, mm-hmm. and everything? There are a lot of restaurants come in. I don't recall if food carts came with it or are displaced by gentrification.
Yeah, Alberta Street is actually a really good example of a gentrified neighborhood, because when Alberta Street was, you know, first became a neighborhood, it was actually a primarily Black community in Portland, and now is heavily gentrified. There are no food carts there.
No.
Yes, but it is a very expensive neighborhood to live in Portland. So it's a very interesting community for sure.
John Dello, and my question is for Nisha. There was a very interesting summary there, and it was interesting and possibly disturbing. My interpretation is that by the time you're 5 years old, you're pretty much set in your empathy and possibly even criminality. Would a five-year-old be, can we change, if he's had a terrible first 5 years, is there any way to change it after that?
My name is Nisha. Our brain is plastic throughout our life, once it doesn't just stop rewiring right when we hit the age of five, so it's plastic throughout our lives. That's why we can learn new things. But it's just, when I mentioned 0 to 5, I just said that this is a particularly sensitive period, but it is not necessarily like it's not an end-all be-all, if that makes sense. But good question.
Yeah, thank you. We got one more questioner.
Mike Rowe, City Club member. My question involves the structure we work under at institutions of higher ed. And at least in yours, it seems there's more flexibility in time and space of how you operate and get your backgrounds. Based on that, I'd like to go back to the structure of class scheduling. Are there classes you think would have been more meaningful to you had you had them earlier in the process, you know, all the 100 level, 200 level classes that we were involved in? Would you have thought somebody ought to take a look at that old structuring and say this would be more beneficial earlier?
Hello, I'm Cal. That is an amazing question. The higher education has been grappling with that question for years and years now, such that there are different tracks of classes. So like we might be mentioning Honors College, so those are very focused for research. And in particular, if I had to pick one class early on that could have shaped my college career a little bit better, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more scientific literacy programs, which the university has, and they're definitely gaining every year with more classes focused on getting undergraduates reading and understanding primary literature, and not only that, but how to communicate research not only in the scientific realm, but to the public as far as translational science is concerned. So that's probably one thing is like, in the undergraduate track to see a little bit more of that translational science going on.
Thank you, Cal. Did you have one? Would you like to respond?
This is Karishma. I think that in terms of the way that university tends to be structured is early on you take very general classes, so, you know, business 101. And so that doesn't lend itself necessarily to you finding the thing that you're most passionate about and the thing you want to write your honors thesis about. So with the honors college, you have to decide pretty early on, pretty much by your sophomore year, what you're researching. And so at that time, chose food gentrification, but I didn't actually take any classes surrounding that topic until last term and this term. So I took last term Mesoamerican Foodways and this term Food and Business. Both of those classes were really instrumental in shaping the way that I structured my thesis, and one of those professors actually sits on my committee now. So it was very interesting, but I wish that I had been able to take those classes a little bit earlier on.
Right, thank you. We'll just have our coordinator has one last piece for us. Mary?
This question is for Allie. And somehow at the end, I wasn't ready for your distinction between the technology that helps and the technology that promotes contact and the technology that doesn't. And I just wondered, ethnographic methods usually come late in training. And I wondered how you happened to come across that way of thinking about your work.
This is Allie. I started out as a hard science major, human physiology and chemistry, and didn't really get an introduction into ethnographic methods until I started my global health minor. And I took a class where we read four books that were all ethnographies, and that was really instrumental in helping me develop my methods.
All right, thank you all for your time today. Give it up. We do have a few quick announcements before we officially thank our guests today. We'd like to thank public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday nights at 6:30. And we'd like to thank Community Television of Lane County, Community Cable 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, we will ask the question from Lane Community College, who needs it? We will have the president, Margaret Hamilton, join us to speak about the value that Lane gives to our community. Please join us next week. For more details and information about future programs, please visit us online at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let's thank our speakers, Calvin Pinkalkas, Karishma Shah, Nisha Sridhar, and Alexandra Waldron. Thank you all for coming down.